Okay, he's okay. A close siren yelped as blue lights spangled the block. Pepper. His cruiser spun up, slinging dirt, grass, and gravel as he slid the car into the lot. The car rocked from the sudden stop, and Pepper jumped out, leaving the car door swinging. Cool. The crowd loved his entrance and began yelling, "Pepper! Pepper! It's Pepper!" calling out his street name. The ambulance, on the tail of his cruiser, turned and crossed the curb. The kids in the crowd got louder, sing-songing the street names of the two cops. "Salt and Pepper! Salt and Pepper!" laughing at each other. "Now, Lil D, put down that knife. Paramedics need to get to Big D. You could talk to your mother. Let her know Big D is going to be okay," Salt kept telling him, watching for his shoulders to lower, watching for the slack in his arm. Little D let it go, slung the knife to the ground, close enough to where Salt could grab it. And the paramedics were on Big D in an instant. Pepper joined the inner circle, pointing to Salt's holster. "Sometimes you too cool. You didn't even unsnap. Must have been hot with the crowd and all. Girl, you can't cut shit so close, so soon." He tapped her head with his knuckles. "You're the cool one. Great entrance. Thanks," she said, and went to catch up with Lil D, walking toward his mom in the car. Lil D's head tilted forward as they walked, pulling the towel to wipe his face. Though his skin was a shade of dark mahogany, the port wine birthmark, darker, stood out clearly from below his left ear to his collarbone. Salt and he both reached for the door handle at the same time. Chanel jumped out and up against her son. As they lifted Big D onto a gurney, Pepper stood by with the paramedics, one of whom gave a thumbs up that Big D would make it. Lil D dashed from his mother to the ambulance. The gang members, including Stone, walking backward, still watching, began to leave the scene. The crowd filled the hot air with a chorus of, "Coup de pop pie, salt and pepper, coup de pop pie, salt and pepper." Pepper, grinning, walked up to Salt at the patrol car. "What's that they're yelling?" he asked, motioning toward the crowd. "Pie?" Chapter 5. Faded Light. It had been 2 a.m. by the time Chanel was booked and the paperwork completed. Except for the 9mm on the seat beside her, Salt's gear, uniform shirt, belt, and all its accessories were stowed in the trunk of her Honda. With her t-shirt drying from the wind coming in the car's open windows and the city lights fading in the rearview mirror, Salt concentrated as the rest of the prayer came to her. "Jesus, tender shepherd, lead me through the darkness. Be thou near me. Guide thy little lamb tonight. Wake me with the morning bright." Halfway into the late-hour commute, flashbacks inserted themselves between the words of the prayer. Big D's ragged shirt, Chanel coming through the darkness, her coup de pot pie, and the birthmark on Lil D's thin neck. A regular Holmes family. She'd arrested every one of them, except a daughter who was young, living with a grandmother. She'd tried to get social services for them, particularly for Lil D when he was young, and she'd been, what, naive? 10 years now, she said out loud. My first night back. What difference will I have made, Pops? As one of the tires bumped over something, Salt jolted back from her altered state, slowed, looked in the rearview mirror, but couldn't see anything except a change in the hue of the pavement. The dark trees in the distance, backlit by some dim source, seemed foreign. One of those moments when even though the road is right, the mind doesn't recognize a familiar way. Then the sign appeared that announced the little town, Cloud, whose rural address was hers, and she felt a quick flutter of relief. Construction of a new mini-mart presented itself, a skeleton on the country landscape. The city was spreading toward her small town and its fields and farms. The trees grew closer to the road as Salt came to her home. Light from a full moon that had just begun to wane struck the glitter of gravel and turned her drive into a sparkle of gray-white. The moon seemed to perch on one of the chimneys of the three-story Victorian house that had been in her family for almost a century. To the right of the house, there were only woods and fields. Her one neighbor was across a field to the left. The car window still down, appreciating the silent view, she turned off the headlights and air conditioner. She parked behind the house and sat listening as the engine cooled and as the quiet night unfolded with a chorus of tree frogs and night birds. Still half on alert, she eyed a plump grocery bag by the doorsteps that hadn't been there in the afternoon. As she got out of her car and approached, she recognized the recycled bag that Mr. Gooden, her old neighbor, often left for her. This one held three large sweet onions. She picked up the bag and unlocked the door. A mid-size all-black dog bounded out and repeatedly, purposely, bumped into her. He kept up the bumping until she had put the onions on the kitchen table. She dropped her gear bag at the bedroom door and went down the long hall to sit on the living room couch, where the dog buried his head in her lap, blowing his breath onto her until she had run her hands all over him, scratched his ears, rubbed his eyes, and vigorously patted his flanks. Some of his soft fur floated onto the hooked rug. Salt lowered her face to his muzzle, and wonder, with the light flick of his tongue, washed dried sweat from her cheeks. He followed her back down the hall to the bedroom and jumped on the old iron bed, eagerly watching her moves. He knew the sequence of the nightly rituals. With each divestiture, 30-pound utility belt unloaded and hung on the closet hook, uniform stripped of brass, department insignia, nameplate, expert pistol pin and badge, and dropped into a pile for the wash. Some of the night's exhaustion abated. Wender knew his time had come as she slipped on torn jeans and laced up old work boots. Salt carried the clothes, smelling faintly of urine, to the kitchen, where she dumped them into the washer. Then she and Wender stood at the screen door and looked out to the pecan grove that spread from the backyard for 3.5 fenced acres. As soon as they stepped out, she gave the dog a lie down in a quiet, almost inaudible voice, then walked to the edge of the yard and clucked softly. The dog, low to the ground, snuck to her feet. Using old Gaelic commands, she gave an away to me, and the dog ran quickly and quietly off to the right, and, even with the moonlight, seemed to disappear. Then they came, like apparitions from the far end of the orchard, 5 fat, mostly white sheep, stepping firmly through the trees with a dog back and forth at their heels. Lamb through the darkness. She thought of Chanel coming out of the dark into that streetlight. When the tiny flock was about 10 yards away, she gave the dog a down, and he dropped to his belly. Salt went over to a small paddock and opened the gate. The sheep jostled each other at the edge of the yard. A soft walk up to the dog, and he raised slowly, staying exactly where he had lain, but forcing the sheep to turn toward her. The lead sheep stepped forward, and the rest followed through the paddock gate, which she closed. Wonder settled in to watch his sheep TV. The little flock grazed under the trees during the day. She fed and watered them at night. Closing the gate, Salt walked to the porch, calling, "That'll do, Wonder," and the dog pulled himself from watching through the slats and came with her into the house. The oak doors of the library were darker, where over the decades her family had placed their hands to push them apart, the spots smoother, slicker than the rest of the blonde wood panels. As the doors glided easily back into their pockets, Salt was enveloped by the fragrance of cedar. Family lore had it that it was her great-grandmother who insisted that the library shelves, which were built six high on each of the four walls, be made of the aromatic red lumber. For more than two centuries, the family had had their roots in this property. Salt was the last to live in the old house, built after the Civil War to replace the original homestead cabin. The library was bereft of all furniture, bare except for a worn Asian carpet and books from each generation. A few of her great-grandmothers had survived, some in Latin, pocket editions of Tennyson, Browning, and Shakespeare, pages brittle and crumbling, leather bindings cracked and flaking, were on the same shelf next to the plastic cases that held her father's blues and gospel cassette collection. There were also books of her grandfather's, but most of the shelves were taken by her father's books. He had had a unique and personal method of organizing and shelving his books. On a waist-high shelf near the door, he kept a ledger that listed which books he'd read each year, and the books were shelved accordingly by year on the east front wall. The books he'd read as a child were on the low shelf of the north wall. On the middle shelves of the east wall were Eudora Welty, Richard Wright, Flannery O'Connor, lots of William Faulkner. "Find out where people come from," he'd say. Walking around their property, he'd remind her, "We've got a lot more than some folks ever had." Other than on the streets, this was the place where Salt felt closest to him. She took a worn copy of Tarzan and the Lost Empire, sat down cross-legged with the book open on her lap, and leaned back against the shelves, remembering the smell of her father's flannel shirt as they sat together in a big leather chair, light from a pole lamp holding them in its warm halo. She was still tired and sad from the post-shooting dreams, her vision not really up to focusing on the words of the book. On the heels of the incident on the expressway, images of her father's death had been asserting themselves. Her hand flattened on the open page, and she lifted her eyes to the rest of the room, the closed brocade drapes, the deep burgundy rug, blurring. There had never been doubt in the family about how the children paired with their parents. After her brother John was born, her mother became absorbed with the baby and left Salt to her father to raise. But it seemed now to Salt that she'd been her father's child anyway, even from her birth. He'd talked to her about Howlin' Wolf, about the blues. "Honey," he'd say, "if you know how people feel, you can understand why they do what they do." He would tell her stories of what happened at work. "Honey, you can predict what someone will do if you understand how they feel. She just needed someone to talk to. It wasn't me she wanted to cut." He'd explain about the pecan trees out back. 100 years old or more. Their flowers are called catkins. He'd talk, and she'd ask for more. She looked over at the last books he'd been reading, some of the titles on their spines in large enough print that she could see them from where she sat. Depression, abnormal psychology, living with someone with a mental illness. Her mother believed Satan had taken hold, kept after him to let the preacher lay his hands on him. "You care more about those people than you do your own family," her mother said once. "It's making you sick." "How did I not know, Pops?" Wonder lay in the hall at the entrance to the library. It was the only room he never wanted to enter. Salt thought it was the cedar, that maybe he didn't like the smell. It had always made her think of old things, old people, winter clothes, jewelry chests, cedar chests, and coffins. Wonder, his head on his paws, kept his eyes open, glancing at her, then back down the hall toward the door. Salt's memory turned to one sharply held incident. It must have been an off-duty day because she was with him. They were going back into the city, going to a movie. She couldn't remember why her mother and brother hadn't come, but it felt special. She couldn't remember what the movie was about, or much else about the day, except that on the way, he told her they needed to stop somewhere, and he said something like where he worked. Not the precinct house, but where he patrolled. She remembered that the facade of the building where they stopped was like that of buildings in the homes, brick with a small porch. She vowed that one day she would go to the police records office and find out if she could retrieve old assignment sheets, find out what beat he'd worked. He'd held her hand as they walked up to a door. "This is my daughter," he'd said to a woman on the other side of the screen. In a deep, soft voice, "I see that," had been the woman's exact reply. Salt was sure of that. It was what she remembered most clearly from that day. There had been a little more talk between her father and the woman. Something had happened the day before. Something about money and milk for the baby. There was a very dark baby on her hip, and more children at her skirt, their hands against the wire mesh at Salt's level, their skin so dark, almost all she could see of them through the screen were their shiny cheeks and eyes. The woman stood behind the screen until he pulled a green envelope, like the ones that had gone with their Christmas cards the year before, out of his shirt pocket and handed it through the slightly opened door. It was all she remembered about that day. Except that back in the car, he took a blue bandana from his pants pocket and wiped his eyes. Salt closed Tarzan and leaned back against a set of Harvard classics. She tightly clutched the book to her chest. "The streets, depression, this house, all of it you let go. And along with all the rest, Pops, you let go of me." Chapter 6. Night. The following day, at the outset of their shift, she and Pepper were standing at the intersection of Mowry and Thurkill, in the dense project, buildings close and distant, as far as the eye could see. Water gushed from a couple of open hydrants into the gutters, evaporating in the heat before it reached the bottom of the block. The project, constructed in the early 1950s, was crammed onto 100 hilly acres. Sturdy old live oaks reached their limbs high above the buildings they shaded, lining the 10 avenues and 2 through streets along which the homes were built. From the packed red dirt of the small yards, the big trees thrust up the knobby knees of their roots. The buildings were all brown brick, each unit with a small 5x7 concrete porch, hemmed with iron pipe railings. There were 700 families, give or take an eviction or two, in 1, 2, and 3-bedroom apartments. Only a few miles south of Atlanta's downtown business district, the 200 buildings housed more citizens than any other development in the city. At the highest point, on Shaw Street, the city skyline and tall buildings appeared like a distant, smoky mountain ridge. Salt was the first female cop to be assigned to the homes, and the first white officer since 2 white officers had shot and killed an unarmed black man there 5 years before. She had asked for the beat, knowing no one would ever be able to say she had had a cushy rookiehood if she worked the homes. Since she was the only one to request it, they had to give it to her or explain the discrimination. The defined community, and even the name the homes, appealed to her, and it was a bonus when Pepper had been assigned to the adjoining beat of warehouses and failing businesses. In the years just prior to Salt's assignment, there had been several instances of children killed by stray gunfire in the homes. Now she and Pepper watched while the kids played in the spray from the illegally opened hydrants, enjoying the luxury of being there together and with the kids, before the calls took them alone and apart. Soundtrack of the shift, their shoulder mics crackling every now and then, with calls for other cars and other beats. Later it would get constant. They were supposed to report open hydrants. Instead, Pepper's eyes were on the street above, watching. There was a 10-mile-per-hour speed limit, but the crests of the hills were only half a block away. You could hear the beater before it came into view. Thumplum, thumplum. Bumper, grill, hood, tires. The driver slowed as the blue strobes of the patrol cars reflected off the windshield. Daylight was no guarantee of sufficient visibility. Things could be missed in the sun's glare, just as in the night's darkness. Sun-shot streams of water ran down the bodies of the 20 or so children, darting from sidewalk to sidewalk and filling the street with jumping, dancing, squeals, screams, and happy shouts. They were oblivious to any danger and to the detritus, medical waste, Big D's scissored shirt, and all that was left from the drama that had occurred in the lot across the corner the night before. Chanel never explained what the fight had been about, only that Big D had a problem with it, but she never said what it was. Some older boys came roll-walking down toward them. This year's home's identifier, limited to the east side of Pryor, was wearing a tennis visor turned upside down, with the bill sticking up, graffiti marked in multicolor. Along with baggy pants, this was the uniform of local gang life, worn with arrogance, defiance, and anger, and more often than not, predicting its wearer's future. "I know what you're thinking," Pepper said, taking a glance at the approaching boys. A trickle of sweat ran through the slick valley of a scar along the left side of his dark, dark brown face. "Some things change and stay the same." When Salt had started at the police academy, Pepper's face had been seamless. All of them fresh-faced rookies. They discovered their birthdays were only a day apart, and that they were the same age, both having just graduated from college. He had drawn her in, though they were an unlikely pair. He was gregarious, light-hearted, and handsome. She reserved and determined. Classmates' curious eyes would hold a second longer, noting a shared laugh between them, or their pairing off at meals when Pepper's wife, Anne, had packed extras for Salt in his lunch. There was only one other woman in their class of 30 rookies, and Tanya had been the flirty type. Salt was not. Some of the guys hit on her. A few were hostile, some indifferent. But Pepper teased, setting her up so she could have the good lines, getting her in on the rowdy back and forth. He was tall and athletic, and the other rookies liked him, wanted him to like them. One day at the firing range, second month into their training, Salt had asked him why he included her. "I like the way you think is all," he had said, and laughed it off. "Everybody needs good backup. Me too." It was Pepper, whose real name was Greer, who had given her the name that stuck. The only name any cop remembered to call her. Salt. From the shiny nameplate she wore opposite the badge on her brand new uniforms. The night of their graduation ceremony, they'd inspected each other. "S. Alt," it says. "Salt," pronounced Pepper. Today, Pepper's smile was directed at the squealing children, the same 100-watt grin that made people want to tell jokes just to keep that light on. She thought of that one rainy night in their first year, after they'd both received their assignment together in what was known as the war zone. The call was to a possible burglary. They had run from the rain to an overhang outside the building. Pepper leaned over and sniffed. "You don't smell like a wet dog." Salt asked what the hell he was talking about. You don't smell like a wet dog. Black folks say white people smell like wet dogs." With Pepper's smile reflecting the bare bulb of the overhang light, She felt like she had been given a perfect gift. She smiled at the memory and caught the eye of a little girl with wheat-colored hair and honey-brown skin who smiled back from the middle of the wet, jumping kids. She and Pepper rescued each other regularly. Not much they learned in the academy had prepared them for these streets. Even Pepper, at first, wondered what they had gotten themselves into. He, at least, understood the language, the accents, the culture of poverty. Though he himself had come from a middle-class home, his parents had come up hard. In the beginning, except for memories of her father's stories and admonitions, Salt felt not much of her own background prepared her for the job in these streets. They both stumbled through their rookie days, comparing experiences, commiserating and consoling. She thought he had taught her more, but he claimed she helped him to sort things out. Two of the littlest boys from the hydrants ran over to Pepper and slung the water from their arms on him, daring each other to stay, while the big cop made mock monster lunges at them. He grabbed them up, one in each arm, their slippery giggling giving way to looks of amazement at being so far off the ground and so near his face. The boy on the opposite side from the scar leaned around Pepper's face to watch as the smaller boy traced his fingers down the long-healed wound. 6 years ago, his face had been slashed. Pepper had made his official statement at the hospital, where the skin and muscle of his face had been reattached with 300 uneven stitches. He told the rest to Salt. A late-in-the-shift call, radio had given it out as a domestic disturbance. No weapon had been described to the 911 call taker, and so no weapon was indicated to the dispatcher, who therefore sent only one car. In this city, one car meant one cop. And almost always, except when a trainee was along. Though they paid lip service to supporting the men and women in blue, the politicians chose. One-person cars meant more cars available for calls. Even though Hot Pepper was aggressive, he was careful, and it was no different that night. He told Salt that he had scanned the area as usual when he got out of the patrol car in front of the project apartment building. He saw nothing except the dark breezeway, the busted bulbs under the stairs, the tunnel of danger on each of the three floors. But while climbing, entering those breezeways with his flashlight in his left hand, right on his holster strap as he ascended to the second level, a warning voice slightly prickled his brain. That was all it was, most of the time. Just a tiny pinch. Not thought, not complete or conscious. He told Salt that this other voice had said blood. It was hard to know whether it was a smell or some motion barely seen or heard. He brought up the flashlight and caught the gleam of a blade coming at him from under the stairwell. Pepper cleared his holster, and the man with the knife was blown backward just after the blade left Pepper's chin. Salt and Pepper spent hours dissecting the other voice. They knew of other cops who hadn't recognized the voice quick enough. Some were alive and would tell you they had heard it. Some wouldn't tell. Some were dead. Pepper's yet beautiful face was testimony to his having listened. They had theories. Angels, God, ESP. But the one they put the most faith in was you know more than you think you do. So after a tough or confusing call, or when they wanted to connect with someone who understood, one or the other would say, just between them, you know more than you think you do. Now, standing at Mowry and Thurkill, Hot Pepper saw her eyes roll up at the sight of the baggy pants boys with the ludicrous visors. He released the squirming boys, who joined hands and ran together into the hard spray of the hydrants. Not long out of their rookie probation period, she and Pepper had been in line in a fast-food burger place when one of the gangbangers walked in, wearing a coonskin hat, about 18 years old. He had exposed nostrils, a lower lip that hung excessively under a smaller upper lip. She had wondered aloud, does he think that hat makes him look better? Pepper had looked at her for just a second, and in a neutral, quiet voice said, he's without hope. He's never known better, and is angry without knowing why. Salt, stung by her ignorance of the simple truth of what he said, turned, looking for judgment, only to see that he cared enough to have told her. The wheat and honey girl came out of the group and stood in front of Salt.
You got black curly hair and you white. I got yellow hair and I'm black.
The girl giggled behind her hand and ran back to her friends. Salt turned, still smiling, to Pepper. Pepper, smiling back at her, said,
yeah, where did you get that black curly hair? From my daddy?
From your mama. She threw and pulled a punch at his scar while he laughed and ducked. He was quick to laugh, but also took to her serious side, backing her always and to others. There had been other times when they talked about chaos and dirty apartments, about the energy it takes to get clothes cleaned when the washing machine is 4 blocks away and you have 5 children to take with you. They traversed the landmine topics of race and gender, and why it took Salt longer to tell Half-Dead from his brother Cat Eye. Both admitting the inaccuracies of eyewitness information across races, speculating that folks of different races didn't fine-tune their observations, didn't get or didn't choose to get close enough, didn't look at others in their faces. They were both learning. Standing there, watching the kids play in a prism of sun-struck water, she said to him, I do know more now, and looking up, thanks to you. Pepper looked at his shoes, then tried to hide a smile as he stepped away a few feet and pulled out his expandable baton. He swung it fiercely in an upward arc so that the metal sections extended, caught, and reflected some of the bright sunlight. He made it, as he often did, like magic, like the light came from his own secret source. He was playing with her. Now kneel down, Blue Knight. And she, playing along, despite the children and now adults forming an impromptu street party, knelt on one knee. He tapped her once on each shoulder with the baton. Since her head was properly bowed, as any good knight's would be, she couldn't see what he was doing, although she thought she heard the sound of Velcro separating, and then she felt him place something around her head. Rise now, thou knight of the homes, he proclaimed. Salt stood up and felt for what he had crowned her with. The children and the Holmes residents laughed, and so did she when she removed the visor of Pepper's police hat, which he had separated from the cloth crown and placed on her head, upside down. A moment to carry them through the night, secretly superstitious that the magic would hold. She checked the crowd and saw the visor boys had disappeared. Chapter 7. Marcy Street. They were just finishing their soup when radio started asking, can any unit clear and start for 541 Marcy Street, apartment B4, on a person down, possibly 48? Salt held the last gulp of soup in her mouth. Signal 48 was the radio code for a dead person, and apartment B4 was Chanel's place. She swallowed, grabbed her shoulder mic and responded, 3306 to radio, I'm clear and en route. Pepper yelled to Mai, hold the satay, throwing money for the check and tip on the table. On the way, Salt imagined talking to Chanel. You can't have. You didn't. You better not have killed Big D. Just last month, Chanel was in her patrol car, eyes crack bright, knowing that even though she had stabbed Big D, he loved her. She could still hear Chanel's pronouncement. He love my coup de pot pie. But it didn't save you, now did it? Salt thought. She lifted her foot from the gas, the familiar sadness causing a moment of breathless sluggishness. A crowd was gathering as she turned onto the short street. The Marcy Street apartment was where Chanel stayed with Big D most of the time, and it was as bad a shithole as it gets. It didn't matter that this call was inevitable. Salt felt flattened by it. She watched for the players and snitches and to see who walked away as the patrol car pulled into view. Witnesses would be quick to disappear when the questions started. Salt parked along the curb, perpendicular to the dingy red-brick apartment building. Pepper made his entrance, tires squealing to a halt behind her car. The Hope Apartments were a short row of 3 four-unit buildings in a development that would have fulfilled only the smallest of hopes. One of the peripheral blights around the homes, they had been built about 10 years before, but in her 10 years in the zone, these apartments had never looked anything but worn out. Before she could get out of the car, Sister Connolly, who was the tallest woman Salt had ever known, appeared at her car door. She owned the little old house across the street, and could tell you who was kin to who as far back as Jesus.
"Lord, that child done found Chanel dead," said Sister, patting the crown of braids on the top of her head with thin, knobby hands, polished with age to a shiny brown. She was a revered elder at the nearby church and had earned the title Sister.
Salt faced forward and focused on a tiny crack in her car's front window. "Damn," she said, shaking her head. Without looking up, she asked Sister Connolly, "Who found her? How do you know she's dead?" She forced her voice to be professional. The weight of another grief made Salt feel her body was too heavy to get out of the car.
"Her girl come over to my house. I called 911. And then went up to that apartment, and I saw her. She been dead 'cause they flies on her."
"Where's the girl?" Salt asked, getting out of the car, trying to focus on anything other than the body she'd have to see. Sister Connolly pointed up at the apartment.
"She the one standing at the door. She followed me when I went up, and I couldn't get her to come away."
A girl of about 11 or 12, wearing all pink, was barring the doorway of the apartment. Also, there were at least a dozen people on the stairs, compromising the crime scene. Pepper was already out, waiting in, calling for the people to come down from the stairs. The crowd was murmuring, "Salt and Pepper, that's Salt and Pepper," as she and Pepper fell into a familiar rhythm. On her way, Salt noticed that all of the apartment's window panes had been painted red on the inside, the paint chipped where there were cracks. She imagined Chanel with a dripping brush of red, jittery and covered in paint. The screen door was broken, just like the last time she had been there, the wire mesh of the screen missing, boards left hanging from one hinge. Sounds came from inside, like someone breaking sheetrock. Lil D stomped out, kicking and slamming his fists into the walls as he came. He knocked into Salt as he rammed the door, causing her to hit her newly healing head on one of the dangling boards, yelling, "I'll kill my own goddamn self!" Salt put out her arm to stop him. He jerked away.
"Don't touch me! Fuck the police!"
"Hold on, Lil D.
She in there dead, man!"
His face contorted with anger and grief. He was trying to put on a fierce look, but the tight muscles around his eyes couldn't hold back the tears.
"Show me where she is. Did you find her?"
Salt sounded harder than she felt.
"You police don't give a damn, and you ain't gonna find Big D, 'cause he don't wanna be found. But I'll find him, and then you can arrest me."
He punched the air as he stomped down the stairs past Salt.
"You just lock her up, and she gets out, and they back in the same old shit."
"How do you know Big D killed her? Were you here when it happened?" Salt called out to him, then dropped her shoulders in exasperation.
"I just know. Who else? They always fighting all the time."
He was halfway down the steps, knocking into people as he went. "Lil D, help me here. Maybe your daddy didn't do it. Did anybody see him kill her? Who was here? She shouted to Pepper, I've got to go see where she is. Hold on to Lil D. Lil D continued punching the air, trying to make his 5'5" thin frame tough. Pepper grabbed him and opened the back door of his cruiser. Salt tried to ignore the ache that was starting in her scalp.
Shush.
She turned to the girl in pink, whose finger was in front of her lips, the sound coming from her puckered mouth, the rest of her face stiff. Salt couldn't tell to whom the admonition was directed. The girl's eyes were focused past Salt on nothing Salt could see.
That my sister!
Lil D yelled from below, looking up as Pepper closed the car door. Salt turned back just as the girl was blinking, as if her vision were returning, surprised to find herself here. She reached out for the girl's arm, asking, Are you? The girl interrupted, answering the question Salt had asked Lil D.
Wasn't nobody here. I found her.
The girl seemed familiar. Salt then realized that the girl looked like Chanel.
Where is she? She in the closet? In the bedroom?
Do you have a key? Salt asked as the girl turned away. Pink barrettes held two thick, neat braids tight against her head. Her blouse, pants, and sneakers were all the same color pink. Cheap clothes, but clean, starched, with ironing marks visible on the cloth.
No key. They don't ever lock the door. Ain't nothing worth stealing anyway. I went in and called her. When she didn't answer, I thought she might still be asleep, 'cause she sometimes doesn't get up till late.
Wait for me at the bottom of the stairs. Salt touched the girl's shoulder. The apartment was grim. The entrance was through a roach-infested kitchen, the stench oppressive. Something meat-like rotting in the filthy sink. Salt hurried through the living room, to the right, and down the short, narrow hall. The bedroom door on the left was open. She stood looking into the room, her eyes adjusting from the daylight to the dark inside. The room was a dim blur. Crumpled, dirty blankets in the middle of the floor took shape, a soiled, bare mattress under the thin, rectangular windows on the wall opposite.
Then I went in there.
The girl appeared at the door, pointing without looking to the inside of the bedroom,
and saw her in the closet.
Her eyes were scanning memory, not the present. There's no need for you to go farther. Salt stepped alone into the bedroom, leaving the girl in the hall. Wet, molding clothes were in piles in every corner of the bedroom, and the blanket mound was empty. The closet door was open, Chanel's familiar, patchy scalp visible on her bowed head. Slumped on the floor, and there was no doubt she was dead. Thick, dark, crusted blood covered her chest and pooled, congealed in her lap. Flies had begun the work of taking Chanel back to nature. At least 8 hours, Salt thought.
Where was I?
She swallowed, her throat tight, as if she needed an alibi. Something flew in front of her face. She lifted her hand to ward it off, but when she turned, the flutter was still there in her vision. The girl stood in the hallway, steadily pulling on each of her fingers, not cracking knuckles, but with a stripping motion.
It's Mother's Day. Chanel is my mama. I live with my grandmother over in Lakewood, so I took the bus to see her. I came in.
Her voice got so soft.
I went out and called Lil D from the corner. Then I went over to Sister Connolly's. Lil D's gonna kill Big D if he can.
Let's go back outside, said Salt, stepping out of the room. The girl just kept pulling at her hands, like she had to finish both of them, one finger at a time. Salt reached out.
We can go now.
Chanel's daughter nodded, still looking but not seeing down the hall. The girl couldn't be more than 12, slender, with skin that shone in the dim apartment. She possessed the frightening calm of some children who have seen too much. Salt touched her back to escort her down the hall. As they moved through the apartment, the girl seemed to be talking to someone, not Salt.
She wasn't careful.
What? Salt said to the girl's back.
Shush,
sounded the girl again. She had gotten the girl back outside and down to Pepper. The paramedics had arrived, and Salt and one of them, her friend Sherry, went back into the crime scene so Chanel could be officially pronounced. Back in the bedroom, Sherry approached the closet and snapped on a latex glove. She batted a fly away from her face.
God, 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 she said, almost like a prayer as she knelt and put two fingers to Chanel's throat.
For half a second, she looked at her watch.
Time of official pronouncement, 7:22 p.m.
Salt wrote it down in her notebook. Sherry turned and took off the glove.
How long? Salt asked. Rigor has set in. 10 hours or more, Sherry answered. Looks like a bullet wound to me.
Back out on the landing, Salt stood blocking anyone from going back in. Below, Pepper was guarding Lil D, locked in the patrol car, with his face turned away from the outside. Pepper bent his head toward Chanel's daughter, talking to her.
Radio, raise a homicide unit, Salt said into her shoulder mic.
Seconds later, a unit came on. 4125, is someone trying to contact homicide?
3306 to 4125. We're at 541 Marcy Street on a 48. Probable GSW, she responded.
En route.
Detectives were on the way. Sister Connolly had gone back across the street to her yard and was looking up at Salt. The tall woman just kept staring, so intently that Salt turned to check the apartment door behind her to see if there was some sign or problem that Sister Connolly could see from her viewpoint that she was missing. There was nothing different. The screen doorboard still held to the frame by that single hinge. She carefully pushed them well clear of the entrance. In the crowd of 30 or more people to the left, exactly straight across the small street, the gang lieutenant and enforcer Stone stood, leaning against another apartment porch support. Wherever there was trouble, he seemed to catch wind of it. He was eating from a bag of chips and looking at the action, his red-brown face impassive, like he was watching a movie. He and Sister Connolly were about the same height and build, with about a 60-year age difference. Stone glanced up, looked over to check out the crowd, then again at Salt, making eye contact. He sprinkled the rest of the chips around the porch, threw the bag in the yard, loped toward the street, looking over his shoulder like a stray dog that's marked its territory. In the patrol car, Lil D knocked on the window. Pepper opened the door, listening while Lil D, face wet and taut, gestured broadly. Pepper motioned for him to move back and close the door again. Salt thought again of Chanel, her last time in custody, in the patrol car back seat. An unmarked detective car pulled up. Wills and Gardner got out, checked with Pepper, then looked up. They had been on other homicides Salt had worked. Both were white guys. Gardner was older and never had much to say, and even though he had classic male pattern baldness, he was the only homicide detective she knew who didn't wear the signature fedora. He and Wills, both always slightly rumpled, were enough alike in their bad sartorial choices to have been shopping from the same thrift store. But where Gardner was thin and lanky, Wills was built like a high school football coach, hard-boned and muscular without the definition, and always seemed to be looking in your eyes. Gardner began taking notes while talking with Pepper. Wills started up the stairs towards Salt.
We've got to quit meeting like this,
he said when he reached the landing, smiling at her. Salt, caught without a comeback, glanced at her notes. Her name is Chanel McLeod. Pronouncement time, 7:22 p.m. Call came in at 6:45. We arrived at 6:55.
How's your head?
He asked. She touched her scalp and felt a piece of scab that was hooked in her hair. Okay, till I knocked it against that board there. She gestured toward the screen door. I'll show you in. He followed her. Salt left him at the bedroom and went back out to protect the entrance, back to where she'd first seen the girl standing. Gardner came up and went in to join Wills. The crime scene van got there, and the scene technicians brought their equipment up, banging their black cases against the wobbly stairs. The funeral home employees, contracted by the city to transport bodies to the morgue, waited down the block in a black hearse. The crowd waited for the high point when the body, locked in a medical examiner's bag, was carried out, covered with a fake velvet cloth. The girl was below, stiffly leaning against Pepper's car. Sister Connolly came over to Pepper, then turned and pulled Chanel's daughter with her toward her house. The girl, her words, the tight braids. Salt ran her fingers through her hair. The scab wouldn't come unstuck, though she kept worrying it. Then, with a sudden rush of guilt, she remembered. Mother's Day. She thought about calling her mother, who still didn't know she had been shot. She thought about the last phone call. Are you enjoying the crock pot we sent for your birthday? I use mine all the time. Jake loves a roast cooked slow. I'm getting our kitchen painted over. John and Susan took the boys over to the beach. Do you see your friends from college? Are you keeping your doors locked? Mr. Gooden told us he would look out for you. Mom, I'm a cop. I look out for Mr. Gooden. He's 80 years old, she had said, speaking of her next-door neighbor. He and his deceased wife Peggy had known her family for generations. You don't need to remind me that you're a cop. No, Ma, I'm sorry. I know you worry. It's just, well, I love you guys too. Tell John, Susan, and the boys hello. Those boys are so cute. You should see them in the pool. Mom, I love you. Why don't you come visit? I will, she said, knowing she wouldn't. Best to Jake. The gurney was being lowered down the steep, shaky iron stairs. Because of the rigor, Chanel's body made the cloth cover stick out in the wrong places. Just like Chanel, Salt thought. The detectives talked to Lil D. Gardner went over to Sister's house, and after getting from the girl that Lil D hadn't been in the apartment when she found Chanel, they cut him loose. Wills told her Chanel's daughter's name was Mary Marie McLeod. Walking back to their cars, Salt asked Pepper, Did you get your mom and Anne something for Mother's Day?
Roses for Mom and tulips for my sweetie.
I need to go to the precinct for a minute. Can you cover my calls?
You feeling okay? Your head bothering you?
I'm okay. I'll catch you in a few. Milking the Chanel is down call. Salt drove behind the old stone church, parked, and turned on her phone. She reached her mother's recorded voice and left a message. Hi, Mom. It's Salt. Sarah. Her voice tightened. Mom, I'm at work, but I didn't want you to think I forgot you today. Her voice felt strained, thinning out. Mom, happy Mother's Day, she said, trying to mask the relief she felt to be talking to the machine that asked no questions and made no comments. She laid her head on the steering wheel and let the memory come of her own discovery of a dead parent, her 10th birthday, left with her father, while her mother and brother went to get the trappings for the celebration. She sat for a minute, then turned on the car and the wipers. The night had come on, accompanied by a pre-rain foggy mist. Waiting for the window to clear, Salt pushed back the image of trying to clear the blood from her father's eyes and mouth. She struggled to remember something about boards, another memory snagged by the broken door on Chanel's apartment. The patrol car windows were clear enough now. She just wished she had a way to clear the cloudy flecks from her eyes. She put the car in gear, hoping to catch a break between calls so she could go look for Big D. And she needed to find Lil D and ask him to pump the street for anything that would lead to who had killed Chanel. Homicide would do their job, but murders on Marcy Street just wouldn't get the same attention from the detectives as a murder on the north side. She prayed softly to Chanel. Your daughter didn't forget. She came to find you. Chapter 8. The War Zone and Lil D. Salt pulled into the precinct parking lot, ready for the Friday night fights, and found the whole shift leaning against their cars, trying to act casual, all early. They cut their eyes to her and looked quickly away. Then she saw her beat car. The big white cruiser was covered in gauze. Thin cotton strips wrapped the tires, trailed like streamers from the windshield wipers, flew like banners from the antennas. On the driver's side door, taped across the city emblem, was a sign that read, "Duck does not mean look up." Salt got out of her Honda, walked over to the decorated car, and in full uniform, boots, hat, gun belt, radio, and baton, put one foot on the push bumper, hoisted herself to the hood, and assumed a calendar girl pose. The pain in her head rattled slightly, then settled. I wondered when you guys would start in on me. She laughed. You knew you were loved when they made jokes about your misfortune. Pepper grabbed his phone and took the picture, all the guys behind her making faces, telling her to say duck instead of cheese. The photo showed her sitting atop the bandaged car, the crease of a scar running through the dark beginnings of her newly grown curls. Officers got worn out, baffled and scared, but never, ever bored. But it was frustrating to pass by the drug dealers night after night, the PD without enough resources to clean up the problem areas, the war on drugs a joke. Some nights, officers would ask other officers to cover for them, stealing time while they tried to identify the players and how they ran the dope traps, their efforts quixotic attempts to gather enough information to either pass on to narcotics detectives or obtain enough probable cause to get their own warrants. Before roll call was over, radio was already asking for units to pull in for calls. Salt didn't bother to unbandage her car. She just rolled out of the precinct, trailing gauze. Another sign on the trunk read, "Just recovered." She handled several calls. On one domestic, some kids had unbandaged her car while she made peace. Then Salt drove to an alley parallel with the front row of some project buildings. Occupied units alternated with the unoccupied and vandalized. Windows were dressed in broken shards. She got a pair of binoculars from her gear bag, hung them around her neck, got out, and started down a dark path. Watching for gang members and dopers who could run to tell the dealers she was in the area on foot, she tried to stay in the shadows. The old-fashioned word ambush came to mind as she put her hands over the silver buttons and badge on her shirt to cut down reflections. Radio, hold me out on foot in the area of 222 Maori, she whispered into the radio mic. The shift would be listening. Nervous until she came on radio and advised she was back in her car. Pepper had agreed to try to catch her calls while she was out. As she watched for the gang, A sizzling awareness of shapes, shadows, and movement sang in her veins, like she thought meth might feel. She switched off the radio. On the rutted and gullied downhill to the abandoned, burned-out apartment, aware of the